Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
And from high atop Leicester Square in London. Well, second story, ladies and gentlemen. But, you know, I wouldn't jump it. I'm going to say goodbye at the outset to our good friends at Wisconsin Public Radio who jumped off the network to replace this broadcast with another hour of the BBC. It's ironic. We're in London. But they were displeased with the political content of the broadcast, don't you know? What a nutty week for them to decide that. It is a week, ladies and gentlemen, when we are finally getting the answer to the long-posed musical question, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? But there's a memory hole to be dug into, and this might be the right time to do it. Here's Colin Powell talking. I mean, I'm going to be reading him. He's not actually talking, so don't look for me to be doing Colin Powell. Here's Colin Powell at a press briefing in 1992, ladies and gentlemen. Quote, Saddam Hussein is a terrible person. He's a threat to his own people. I think his people would be better off with a different leader. But there is this sort of romantic notion that if Saddam Hussein got hit by a bus tomorrow, some Jeffersonian Democrat is waiting in the wings to hold popular elections. You're going to get, guess what, probably another Saddam Hussein. It will take a little while for them to paint the pictures all over the walls again, at which time he gets a laugh, according to the transcript. But there should be no illusions about the nature of that country or its society. And the American people and all of the people who second-guess us now, in 1992, would have been outraged if we'd gone on to Baghdad and we found ourselves in Baghdad with American soldiers patrolling the streets 2 years later, still looking for Jefferson. Colin Powell, 1992. Here is Daniel Pipes, who most recently, he's the director of the Middle East Forum, and most recently has been a supporter of the Iraq War. But here he is in 1991. Iraqis, their neighbors, and the outside world have all been served reasonably well by the delicate balance of power, which leaves Iraq neither too strong nor too weak. Yet this balance is a one-time thing. When undone, it is permanently gone. Getting rid of Saddam increases the prospects of Iraqi civil war, Iranian and Syrian expansionism, hello, doctor, Kurdish irredentism, and Turkish instability. Do we really want to open these cans of worms? The only way to avoid these consequences of toppling Iraq, toppling Hussein, according to Pipes, was, quote, a very intrusive and protracted U.S. military presence in Iraq. Daniel Pipes, 1991. And from the Telegraph, British newspaper, in 2003, not just near the top of the memory hole, but just before the war begins. War with Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq is the Telegraph is a pro Iraq War newspaper, ladies and gentlemen, editorially speaking, and was in 2003, in March, when this was written. But this isn't an editorial. This is a news analysis. War with Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq is the centerpiece of a grand American strategy to transform the Middle East that is as ambitious and idealistic as it is fraught with pitfalls. Quote, people who think like me get accused of having messianic views on the subject, unquote, according to a senior Bush administration official, seen as one of the principal intellectual forces behind the Iraq policy of regime change. Quoting again, the same official, the truth of the matter is it starts from a view that real stability doesn't come from blocking people's hopes and aspirations. Instead, he said, America should create the conditions for democracy to flourish. This tentative domino theory of democratic change in the Middle East is one of the main reasons it is spoken of so rarely as the reason for the Iraq war. But the momentum toward the drive behind the drive towards toppling Saddam has been provided by men who identified him as a danger nearly 25 years ago and who believe that regime change could help bring about a transformation of the whole region. These include Paul Wolfowitz, a Pentagon official who was the U.S. Defense Deputy Secretary. He was the author of a June 1979 paper that highlighted the growing military threat to the Gulf region posed by Saddam. Innocuously titled Capabilities for Limited Contingencies in the Persian Gulf, the paper remains classified to this day. 5 years before the war began, Wolfowitz, Zalmay Khalilzad, now our ambassador to Iraq, and 16 others, including Donald Rumsfeld, penned a letter to then-President Bill Clinton. It stated that failing to move towards the removal of Saddam Hussein's regime would, quote, have a seriously destabilizing effect on the entire Middle East. Ladies and gentlemen, unquote. It all sounds so nostalgic, doesn't it? Anyway, as I say, we're in London, and it's ironic that they left us in Wisconsin because we're so like the BBC right now. As a matter of fact, although we're in the studios of Capital Radio, we're going to cross over to our BBC announcer right now. Roger?
This is London. Le Show World Service. I'm Roger Pink at Le Show House. And now, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Le Show.
Gets scary down in that memory hole, doesn't it, ladies and gentlemen? From Leicester Square in London, I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of the show. And now, time for the apologies and semi-apologies of the week.
We're almost sorry.
Starting with an almost apology from Gail Collins, editorial page editor of the New York Times in Editor and Publisher magazine. Quote, if I had to do it all over again, I would have paid a lot more attention to the people on the editorial board who had doubts about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, Collins said this week. I thought there were weapons of mass destruction, and most of the board members did. Frankly, we did not spend enough time debating the issue. She said, Gail. She said that led to early editorials that proclaimed the existence as a matter of fact, rather than a questionable assertion. We should have argued among ourselves more, she stressed, given our readers some of a sense that there was an argument about it. We tended to take it for granted. Dateline Los Angeles, Sony Corporation this week said it has pulled a Dutch billboard advertising campaign for the new white version of its PlayStation portable video game player and apologized by anyone to anyone offended by the ad, which critics dubbed racist. A billboard ad in the campaign, which Sony said was launched in the first week of June, created exclusively for the Dutch market, portrayed a white woman aggressively grabbing the face of a black woman and read, quote, PlayStation Portable White is coming.
Sorry.
Sony said in a statement that the Netherlands campaign intended to highlight the color contrast between the existing black PlayStation player and the new ceramic white PlayStation player. Quote, we recognize the subject matter of one specific image may have caused concern in some countries not directly affected by the advertising. As a result, we have now withdrawn the campaign, said the company, which also apologized to those offended by the ad. By the way, hats off to the European Community Court, which told Sony and BMG, no, you can't merge. What a nutty thing to do. Deadline Jacksonville, Florida. Former Corrections Department Secretary James Crosby Jr. pleaded guilty this week to taking thousands of dollars in kickbacks from a prison contractor, blaming some of his actions on alcohol abuse. All right, then. After entering his guilty plea, Crosby told reporters he was ashamed. I apologize to everyone. What I did was wrong, Crosby said. I wish I could take it back. By which I guess he means give the money back. You know this. Dateline Paris, French soccer star Zinedine Zidane apologized for headbutting an Italian opponent during the World Cup final, saying he was provoked by harsh insults about his mother and sister. So next time, if you don't want to be headbutted, insult his brother. From the International Herald Tribune, the obituary of a former Irish Prime Minister, Charles Haughey, on June 14th, quoted one of his former cabinet ministers, Mayor Geoghegan Quinn, in the same paragraph as a mention of his longstanding mistress. The mistress, whose name was not given in the article, was Terry Keane. We apologize for any implication that it might have been Geoghegan Quinn. And I apologize for mispronouncing your name. Dateline Denver, beer magnate. Ooh, wouldn't you love to be a beer magnate? No, you know what I mean. Beer heir. Wouldn't you love to have beer hair? Look, let me just finish, will you? Former Republican U.S. Senate candidate Pete Coors, you see what I'm saying, was arrested on a drunken driving charge and is due to appear in court next week. Coors ran a stop sign around the corner from his home around 11:25 p.m. Coors stopped his 2004 green Jaguar in his driveway. The trooper smelled alcohol. Coors was released from jail. He said he was headed home from a wedding reception. Quote, I should have planned ahead for a ride. Coors said in a written statement, for years, I've advocated the responsible use of our company's products. That's still my message and our company's message. I am sorry that I didn't follow it myself. You know, read the copy. Not on the prompter, just actually read it to yourself silently. Dateline Salinas, California, Senator Abel Maldonado, Republican of Santa Maria. Yes, you recognize the name of Santa Maria. It's where the Jackson trial was last year. He apologizes for comments he made in a Los Angeles dog trainer article questioning Governor Schwarzenegger's commitment to the state's Latino community. Schwarzenegger made a campaign stop in Southern California Tuesday to renew his support for the civilian Minuteman border patrols and to showcase his Latino supporters. Look, my Latino supporters. According to a report in the Los Angeles Times, not long after Schwarzenegger's appearance at a Mexican restaurant in Linwood, Maldonado, who is the state's highest-ranking Latino Republican, questioned the governor's loyalty to Latinos, saying, quote, when he needs Latinos, Latinos are always there for him. When Latinos need him, the answer's been no. Maldonado later apologized for his remarks. I wonder how many phone calls that took. Quote, I apologize to Governor Schwarzenegger for my public comments to the Los Angeles Times. The governor and I have worked together for the past blah, 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 blah. I continue to support the governor in his efforts to strengthen California. Okay. Job well done. Dateline York, Pennsylvania. The county sheriff has apologized for what he called an embarrassing and egregious security breakdown after court security workers missed a knife later allegedly thrown at a judge in a courtroom. That's a knife you want to catch. Terry Lee Rame was arrested Thursday after authorities said he threw a 13-inch butcher knife at Judge Michael J. Brillhart, who was seated on the bench. The knife went over the heads of several in-county employees and a defendant and sank into a wall to the judge's left. No one was injured. Also found on Rame after he was taken into custody were a 4-inch knife, a 3-pound handheld sledgehammer, and a utility knife with a blade. York Sheriff Bill Hose said his deputy should have taken further steps after the man handed them a barbecue fork at the county courthouse rather than letting him pass inside. Simply put, said Hose, we screwed up. The deputy became transfixed or mesmerized on the one item as he had tunnel vision. There is absolutely no excuse other than human failure. So the guy handed him a barbecue fork and got in with a sledgehammer and a butcher knife. He must have been planning dinner. Action superstar Jackie Chan has apologized and asked for forgiveness after getting drunk and jumping on stage at a concert. Last week, Chan was attending a performance by Taiwanese singer-songwriter Jonathan Lee when he unexpectedly took to the stage, started swearing and hassling the band and Lee. Chan's pop star son, J.C. Chan, who knew? Counts Lee as a musical inspiration, has also repeatedly apologized for his father's bizarre behavior, saying but Chan was drunk when he got on stage and he forgot there were so many people watching. He also said it was his first time. Dateline Washington, D.C. A D.C. police investigator has apologized for making a racially insensitive remark at a community meeting to address last week's killing of a British citizen in Washington. At Monday's meeting, Andy Solberg urged residents to report suspicious activity. He said, quote, this is not a racial thing to say that black people are unusual in Georgetown. This is a fact of life, unquote. At a news conference, Solberg apologized for the remark and asked for forgiveness. He said his remark was inartful. Yes, there's not enough art in the remarks by police officials these days, ladies and gentlemen, don't you think? And he said it wasn't meant to be mean, malicious, or divisive. Solberg's remark prompted Police Chief Charles Ramsey to temporarily reassign Solberg to the art department. Dateline Baghdad, the United States ambassador and the top American military commander have together issued an unusual apology for the rape and murder of a young Iraqi woman and the killing of her family, saying that the crime in which at least 4 soldiers are suspect had injured the Iraqi people as a whole. With a W. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. You know, the United States is... I'm here outside the bubble for 6 weeks, and it's no news to many Americans that we're not exactly making the largest number of friends around the world right now, you know? And I'm not here to do that. Don't get me wrong. I'm not here on a, you know, goodwill visit. Take it from me. You know me better than that. But I'm just pointing out that this next story really, really isn't necessary. We don't really need to go out of our way and have people like NBC Sports President Dick Ebersol, I think he's chairman now, make people more ticked off at us than they already are. This is from, what's the name of this rag? Well, they don't put the name on every page of the paper. I think it's they're all tabloids these days in Britain, so you can't tell. I think it's The Independent. British sports fans, no, it's The Telegraph. British sports fans will have to get up at 3 a.m. to see some of the biggest events at the next Olympic Games in Beijing because the starting times are being changed to suit American television. See what I'm saying? Showpiece finals in swimming have been moved from their traditional evening slots to the morning to please NBC, which is a key sponsor of the Olympic movement. Yes, it's a movement. The finals of some athletic... It's not a business, it's a movement. The finals of some athletics events, such as the men's 100-meter, the gymnastics, and men's basketball tournament, may also be moved for the same reason. The International Olympic Committee, which run the Olympics, has sparked a global row with broadcasters in Europe and Asia, including the BBC, which accuse it of pandering to American pressure and penalizing audiences in the rest of the world. Senior BBC executive said, quote, if the swimming finals had been held as usual in the early evening in China, then people in Britain would have been able to watch them live around lunchtime. But the IOC seems to have agreed to NBC's request to the morning, which will force anyone who's keen to see them to get up at 3 a.m. or stay up late. We'll get low audiences. People have to get to work or won't stay up. It's crazy. Still quoting the British executive. The whole thing about the Olympics is our audiences around the world are on the edge of their seats waiting to watch big sports live, and that's what creates the drama. That will be lost in 2008, unquote. The executive said NBC had also asked for some of the other glamorous finals in the Olympics timetable, including track and field, gymnastics, and basketball, all of which are popular in the United States, to be moved. Making friends wherever we go, ladies and gentlemen. Doing whatever we can, because we can. Now, there's a war on terror, we are told. So we were very, you know, it's almost 5 years since the war on terror was declared. We must be pretty darn serious about it now, don't you think? No, I'm serious. I mean, we've had almost 5 years to get good at it. We probably are pretty good at it. So let's just take a quick survey around the news of the week and see just how good we are at the war on terror. From the Washington Post today, the U.S. government has made limited headway in identifying and securing the domestic targets whose destruction would pose the greatest threat to American lives and national defense, according to experts and former government officials. The Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General reported that a department target list has grown exponentially from 160 3 years ago to 77,000 today, but it is filled with bean festivals, car dealerships, small-town parades, and check-cashing stores as terrorist targets, ladies and gentlemen. You see what I'm saying? It's a good list. The controversy highlights the latest government's latest struggle toward accomplishing the fundamental tasks of identifying targets most vital to the nation's health, economy, and security, ranking them, and deciding how to secure them using scarce tax dollars. President Clinton signed a directive in 1998 that called for the country to come up with a plan to defend its vital infrastructure. By 2003, President Bush called again for a national plan in December of 2003. Yet despite $18 billion a year in government spending, it appears, says the Congressional Research Service, that the Department of Homeland Security is not yet able to base its critical infrastructure resource allocations on risk analyzed in a systematic manner. Homeland Security officials largely blame the delay on the profound challenge of terrorism. Department officials defend the database, which includes petting zoos, donut shops, popcorn stands, and ice cream parlors. Reviews have been done for about 40 nuclear plants and chemical facilities around Detroit. Plans should be done for Chicago and Los Angeles by September. All right, then. And Houston, northern New Jersey, and lower Delaware River next year. The department will then turn, this will be in 2006, to liquefied natural gas facilities, oil refineries, pipelines, dams, and mass transit. Because we care so very much. From the Baltimore Sun this week, for 8 months, a quiet battle has raged between two federal agencies that piece together clues of potential terror threats. The feud has left officials without information about potential dangers, and it has persisted despite a White House deadline, which passed last month, to reach a resolution. The dispute is not about the clues of potential terror threats, but what to call them. With more than 100 labels in use among various federal agencies to identify types of unclassified but sensitive information and who accesses it, the Justice and Homeland Security departments were assigned last year to consolidate the list to just a few labels that would be shared by all agencies. Some within those agencies have been reluctant to give up the labels they're familiar with, but control over who gets information. Stalled by turf wars and unclear lines of authority and control, says an official, according to reporting on this initiative to unify the labels of terror clues. He added the report is also expected to target a lack of presidential leadership on the issue. You know, I wonder who they're talking about there. The labels have become an excuse not to share information. The Congressional Research Service says these pseudo-classification markings have in some instances had the effect of deterring information sharing for Homeland Security purposes. Even when the information does filter down to the state or local level, officials have found themselves at the state or local level befuddled by the bureaucratic jargon, wondering how important the information is, much less how they should handle it and who else can see it. The term for official use only, for instance, is used by 13 federal agencies, and there are at least five different definitions of it. A group of state officials proposed a new system with three designations: law enforcement sensitive, homeland security sensitive, and for official use only. Homeland and justice officials said it was not viable, says Colonel Ken Bush, who led the effort. We really don't understand why. We're frustrated, and we really need this resolved, he adds. Because we care so much about Homeland Security. And finally, the Government Accountability Office has criticized the Defense Department for sloppy management of its security classification system, including marking confidential or secret material that Pentagon officials acknowledged was unclassified information. The GAO says one of the major questions raised by its study was whether all the information marked as classified met established criteria for classification. Because, ladies and gentlemen, we really care.
I registered to vote today. Felt like a fool. Had to do it anyway. Down at the high school. Think about the second line. You know, felt like a fool. People say it all the time, even when it's true. So who's that cold chip sticking on the sole of my shoe? Turned enemy, so I was wrong.
I could be wrong again. I remember once in a loadout down in Birmingham. Yeah, but that didn't feel like love.
This is Le Show from London, and let's do like the American media do. Let's talk about show business. What the hell? The Associated Press is protesting Fox's policy of barring photographers from its news conferences at the Television Critics Association taking place in Pasadena, California this week. The AP says it won't cover the events unless the network changes the policy. This has happened already. I don't know if AP actually covered the event. Fox asked journalists to accept handout photos from photographers it hired. AP says that decision interferes with its ability to fully report the event and sets a bad precedent. Television networks bring executives and stars to that Pasadena Conference Center twice a year to meet with journalists. What they mean is people who write about television, but they call them here journalists. From across the country. Unless Fox allows it to send its own photographers, the AP had threatened not to assign any print journalists, that is to say people who write about television, to cover Fox's promotional events. Fox wants to make sure the images from their publicity event are flattering to the network by controlling the content and distribution of the pictures, says AP. Fox spokesperson Scott Grogan declined to comment on the AP's protest. Another Fox spokesman, Joe Early, told Variety, the show business newspaper, he wouldn't give the reasons for Fox's decision, but labeled it unfortunate the AP as, quote, reacted in such an aggressive and detrimental manner, unquote. Yeah, that's right. Fox doesn't ever react in an aggressive manner. It's outside their DNA. But they're a, you know, big First Amendment supporter. Do they still have a First Amendment in America? I've been gone for 3 days. I didn't see whether they kept it. And Dateline New York. There are expanded editions coming out next month of the first two albums of the made-up pop band of the 60s, the Monkees. But according to Billboard magazine, don't expect any reunions of the original four Monkees. There's a history of intra-band acrimony. Imagine that. The Monkees last toured with all four original members in 1997. Minus Michael Nesmith, members Mickey Dolenz, Peter Tork, and Davy Jones occasionally hit the road subsequently to 1997, but they have no plans to work together in the future, even though, as I say, there's a re-release of their wonderful records. Quote, I would not work with those guys again if my life depended on it, Davy Jones recently told Scripps Howard News Service. I can't be responsible for their attitudes and the way they treat people.
Walking down the street is now a thing of the past. All the folks we meet became believers at last. Thank you.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Soft, listen to the warm.
Dateline Washington, the Arctic ecosystem is a canary in the coal mine of global warming, says Susan Cutts, an environmental science professor from the University of Calgary, at a Capitol Hill briefing this week. By tracking disease rates, eating habits, and population densities in Arctic species such as musk oxen, polar bears, and Arctic yellow cedars, it's possible to gain insight on what will happen globally. Data show musk oxen in Canada are parasite-ridden, polar bears in Alaska have turned to cannibalism, and trees in Alaska are thinning and catching fire. I'm not talking about mites or coods or woods. Glenn Patrick Jude, a professor of forest ecology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, says of the effects of increased temperatures in the Arctic, I'm talking about what has happened. It's not a close call. It's not equivocal. It's not hard to discern. He says it's kind of a smoking gun in the face sort of thing. Make you cough when that smoking gets in your face. The internal combustion engine contributes massively to global warming. Kills around 1.2 million people a year in road accidents, and scientists now warn is costing billions of dollars in crop damage each year. The villain is ozone. At ground level, ozone can be dangerous. It's inflicting a rising bill in damage to food plants, especially in regions where hot, sunny, windless conditions favor ozone formation. But there's more news about warming and crops, but we'll get to that in a moment. Rising temperatures across the American West are helping to fuel larger and more frequent wildfires, a new study by San Diego scientists suggests. The finding by researchers at Scripps Oceanography Institute and the University of Arizona is the most systematic analysis to date of the possible reasons for the rapid rise in wildfires since the late 80s. Quote, I see this as one of the first big indicators of climate change impacts in the continental United States, says co-author Thomas Swetnam. Lots of people think climate change and the ecological responses are 50 to 100 years away, but it's not. It's happening now in forest ecosystems through fire, he says. So the fire this time. As the use of nuclear power expands, it will become increasingly ineffective at combating global warming, warns a report by an independent think tank this week. The Oxford Research Group argues that a worldwide shortage of high-grade uranium ore will force new nuclear reactors to exploit increasingly lower-grade ores for their fuel because that requires more energy to extract the lower-grade ore. The process will result in ever greater amounts of pollution, ladies and gentlemen. Now, about crops. Extreme weather events triggered by global warming threaten to eliminate more than 80% of the best U.S. wine-producing regions by the end of the century, according to a new study published this week. The report's conclusions, appearing online in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, could have multi-billion-dollar implications for the U.S. wine industry. We're likely to see some very dramatic changes in sectors that are not only economically important, but culturally and aesthetically very valuable, says Noah Diffenbaugh, a co-author. In the last 50 years, average temperatures have warmed by about 1.6 degrees Fahrenheit in the main wine-producing regions of California, Oregon, and Washington. But what's bad news for California winemakers could be good news for the Northwest. The study says global warming could hurt California's wine industry, but Washington and Oregon vineyards would be winners. Says Stan Clark. He directs the wine center of Walla Walla Community College and says vineyards throughout the Northwest will grow grapes more easily. And it's hot in London, I can tell you that. That's all I know. About the whole deal, actually, is it's hot in London. It's summertime. What do you want? Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you saw it. Dan Rather made his first post exit of CBS appearance on Larry King Live this past week. And they talked a lot about Dan, the circumstances that surrounded Dan's departure from CBS, and a little bit towards the end about Dan's new gig with HDNet, an all high definition television network where he'll be doing news programs and documentaries, a network that currently has about 3 million subscribers, owned by billionaire Mark Cuban, who also owns the Dallas Mavericks basketball team. And one of the interesting facts brought up in the broadcast was that, as we talked about here last week, Larry asked Dan, Dan, I call him. I'm a first name basis with everybody, ladies and gentlemen. You know, we're in show business here. It's all show business. Larry asked Dan about the report that Dan had refused to participate in a PBS tribute to Walter Cronkite, his predecessor in the job, and a man whom he helped to, Larry didn't say this, but a man whom Dan had helped to ease out to make way for Dan, leaving Walter in a job with no duties but an office. And rather said to Larry, quote, if you want to stay with a desk and a secretary in an office, certainly not an office right here. Oh, no, sorry. This was the offer that they made to Dan, that he could stay with a desk and a secretary, but no job. But anybody who knows me knows that, you know, I want to work. I'd much rather wear out than rust out. And for others, that may be a good way to go, and some others have gone that way. They're quite comfortable with taking an office. Didn't say he was referring to Uncle Walter, but didn't say he didn't. Anyway, it... That was what was on the air. What came next might be described as the first episode in a new series of High Definition Dan, next here on the show.
It was not Harry's fault.
No, it sure wasn't.
There you go, Mr. King. All clean.
Thanks, Jasmine.
Want me to take your makeup off, Mr. Rather?
You know what? I think I'll just take a baby wiper, too, and do it myself.
Okay, here you go.
Thank you. Interest CNN makeup remover? Are you going to do it yourself over at HDNet?
You know something, Brother King? I just might have to.
Come on. This guy Cuban pees money.
Well, I just hope that's not how he pays me. We didn't spend too much time on the whole thing about me leaving CBS, did we?
Well, I mean, that's what people are...
I mean, I'm angry wasp determined not to be appearing to ask for sympathy over my 44-year career at CBS News, and I think it's fair to say it was a boyhood dream come true until the lawyers and the bean counters took over the place and started treating me like syphilitic hired help.
No, I don't think anybody thinks you're asking for sympathy, Dan. I mean, you did the whole shtick about the people who work with their hands and their backs, you know, being the ones who really have it hard. You did that good.
Because, you know, far be it from this hombre to be crying in his saddle. I mean, I don't think we lingered unduly about my feelings about Brother Moonfaced.
Whoa. You didn't call him that on the air. Maybe we should tape an extra segment.
No, sir, I know you got things to do, and I got to... not have a desk at CBS News and do nothing. But we don't want to make too much of that. Because...
excuse me, Dan. It's my producer. Yeah.
Because, you know, the man who drives a taxi...
Is Nancy Grace doing Amber Fry's husband?
Don't think we overdid it, though.
Yeah. Well, it's fine. Let's do them.
Because...
Hold it. Yeah, the whole hour. We can bump Mubarak, can't we?
I mean... Sure, it hurt to...
Okay, Amber Fry's husband in the first half, Mubarak in the second. Phone calls for Mr. Fry. You got it. Thanks. Look, Dan, I think we gave you plenty of time to talk about your new thing, but, only, what, 3 million people could even get it if they wanted to. So I think we were only being responsible broadcasters by talking about something that more people can relate to. I mean, geez, you know, so many people have been fired or laid off, and they think their bosses are schmucks, but, you know, most of them don't get to come on Larry King Live and say so.
Unless they're Amber Fry's husband.
Or Hosni Mubarak.
Look, Larry, I'm not bellyaching. I'm new bride, happy to be doing my new job, and I'm kidding the world relieved to be out of where I was. I just didn't want to come off like some... sour graper, because there are people in Zambia earning $1 a year, and...
Yeah, but Tom Brokaw and Ted Koppel got to leave on their own terms, so,
and
you know...
And as far as not speaking to the people at the Cronkite tribute, I did say, didn't I, that Walter didn't ask me?
Yeah. I forgot to ask you why he would. I mean, you know, CBS is doing the Dan Rather tribute. It's not up to you to ask people to comment on it, is it?
Larry, sir, I thought she took off your makeup. Show's dead jackrabbit over, sir.
Yeah, it is, but, I mean, I'm trying to leave. And...
Oh, I didn't mean to be blocking the doorway here, sir. Seriously, I'm sure and Carly embarrassed to find myself in this position, but...
Well, I got a day with a sandwich and a half at Nate and Al's. You know what they say, one sandwich not enough, two too many, order one and a half. You won't leave.
Know it well, sir. Just want to make sure we didn't come across as some sort of self-pitying, self-absorbed, self-righteous self. You know, that would be sadder than a three-legged heifer.
It would be. And you won't. Mm. We'll do it again soon, Dan, when you do your first show for Mark Cuban.
Yes, sir. Mark that well.
Good night, Jasmine. Bring you something from the deli.
Might be stale by tomorrow, Larry.
You got that right.
Suppose I could just go home and watch the tape, but I didn't come off as...
No, sir, you didn't. Good night.
Thanks for the baby wipe.
Ladies and gentlemen, maybe, you know, California could start raising the stuff they raise in Mexico, like, I don't know, tainted vegetables. Tainted with pesticides, I mean. But with that supposition, we're going to have to put the cap on this edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at this same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, up and down the around the world to the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant, the planet WBCQ, 7.415 megahertz, on 136, channel 136 of Sirius Satellite Radio, available as a free download at www.audible.com/Le Show, available whenever you want it, on your computer at two different locations around the world, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, live and archived, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'll be just like learning to grow Mexican crops in California, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you really? All righty. Thank you very much. Email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. Thanks to Richard and Adrian at Capital Radio London for helping to make today's broadcast possible. Le Show playlist available at harryshearer.com. And as always, and I'm abashed that this is the first time I've mentioned it, backstage production assistance by Pam Halstead. You know, maybe we can start making really good tequila in California. Who knows? Something to think about. It's an opportunity, ladies and gentlemen. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world, even here in Leicester Square, as the home of the homeless. So long from London. Tom? So long from London? Yeah.